Good morning. We're going to be kicking off a new preaching series this morning, and we're going to be looking at and preaching through the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. Genesis has always been one of my favourite books of the Bible. I think we're going to really enjoy being in it. It's got loads of very famous stories in there. Adam and Eve, where we'll be today, and you've got Cain and Abel and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and his dream coat. I think it's going to be great. We called it Origin Stories. I think we probably all are aware that today, researching our heritage and our ancestry has become very popular pastime. My wife and I got for my dad a subscription to Ancestry.com for Christmas, and I think he's very much enjoying that. And it's popular to do this because we know on some level that as we learn about where we have come from, we actually better understand who we are ourselves. And that's true, I think, for understanding ourselves better and knowing our past. And the same for others. If we want to know a bit more about other people, often we look to their origins to find out. And Marvel know this, Disney know this, and they're making a host of, and they have been making a host of Marvel origin stories films for their significant characters, because it helps us to understand who they are. I think we do get that, but actually relatively in the West today, we don't make that much of it, relatively. Other cultures know this even more, and they know how important it is to understand heritage and where we've come from. And Genesis, the book, tells the origin story of everything, the universe, and that's what will be there today. And that includes you, in case you didn't know. So understanding the origin story of everything will help us to understand who we are today. And Genesis tells the origin story of Abraham's family, or the people of God. And if you're a Christian this morning, if you're a member of the people of God, then that includes you. It says in the New Testament, in Galatians, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So this is your origin story, the origin story of Abraham's family. And actually, I think even if you're not a believer, as we go through, we will find that much of our modern way of thinking about the world, our worldview, originates here in Genesis. Because the modern world, I don't think you'd call it Christian now, but in some sense, it used to be and has been so heavily influenced by Christian thinking. We now kind of live in a post-Christian world. And so whatever the details of your conclusions, the way you think about the world today, there's plenty of things that we actually all assume, and we only assume them because of the origin of the story of the book of Genesis, what originates in this book. And we're going to work through this one origin story of Genesis, and that has in itself is one story but contains lots of smaller origin stories. Generally going to look at one narrative each week. In our ancestry, when we do look into our ancestry, you kind of want to find something interesting, don't you? But that you're not so much looking for, you know, lying murderers. That's not so positive. As we go through this book, we will find that as Christians, you know, the book of Genesis is not made up of a load of heroes. We don't come from a line of heroes or even necessarily people that we would aspire to be like, getting glimpses of it. But really, we will see that we come from a line of very flawed people who were recipients of God's grace. We'll see a good God and flawed people who are rescued by this good God, just like us. And this morning got kind of four big origin stories to introduce. We're going to be going through Genesis chapter 1 to 3. These stories we're going to look at today, we're going to look at the origin story of the universe, of everything, the origin story of humanity, the origin story of sin, and the origin story of hope. That's quite a lot to cover, Genesis 1 to 3. We'll touch on things and kind of brush over things that we could spend weeks on in themselves, but we'll let the passage speak for itself and tell us what the main points are that it's trying to communicate. And even today, there's four origin stories in a way, but this as well is one story in and of itself. So we'll start with the origin story of the universe, of everything. Now, I'm not going to read all of Genesis 1 to 3 today, so we'll just read bits. I'm going to read Genesis 1, the first five verses. This is a treat. This is the easiest day of the that you will ever get to find the passage in the Bible. It is the first bit. Once you've got all through the contents and whatever other bits might be in your book, do open it up in Genesis 1. We'll be reading the first five verses. It says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, 'Let there be light.' And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day." The Bible begins, "In the beginning, God." I can't do an origin story of God today because uniquely God has no origin. We see that straight away. God is self-sufficient. He is truly independent and unoriginate. He is the only uncaused cause. Everything else is to some extent an effect as well as maybe a cause. God is the uncaused cause. Immediately in these first words of the Bible, we see God is different to us. He is different. And even in these first couple of verses, the Trinity is hinted at. I'm not saying you get a solid theology from here, but it's hinted at. When in the beginning God created, the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, and then God created by the power of his word. He spoke everything into creation. We find out later that the word, in fact later in the Bible, the word is the Son, the Logos. So God is introduced and he creates. When we're reading Genesis 1, it is important that we approach the passage asking the right questions. Now, the way we think today, we often want to know things like, okay, how exactly did this all happen? What are the details here? And you maybe have got very good questions and concerns over the details of the origin story of the universe. Those questions are very valid. They're good questions to ask. But when we're reading Genesis, we need to ask the right questions and ultimately let the passage tell us what it is talking about. That is the privilege of a writer. You write something down, you get to decide what you are writing about. And so we let the passage do that, and we don't try and tell the passage what it's talking about. So I'll just say straight up in this series, things like the scientific details and the chemical reaction, the dinosaurs and all of that, they're not what Genesis 1 is primarily interested in. And so we won't go there in this morning or really through this series, but we will focus on what the passage focuses on. Now, again, happy if you have those questions, they're very valid and happy to chat those things through and maybe point you in the direction of some resources we could talk about. Feel free to come and talk to me. But that's not where we're going today, because what this passage does want to make clear, one of the things, is that God, the God of the Bible, Yahweh, created the universe. Every culture through history has its own creation story, because I think every culture knows it matters. The origin story of the universe matters to help us understand things today. Mesopotamia, kind of Assyria and Babylon of those days, their story was that their god Marduk, who created it when he killed the ocean goddess Tiamat and used the remains of her corpse and used those to create the universe. That's the Mesopotamia. That was what the Mesopotamians thought. In Egypt, their story was different. Their creation story was that it was their god Atum, A-T-U-M, who made the universe. And he made it kind of a few different things, ideas that he made it from. Some say his spit, or some say his snot or semen that he used to create the universe. Now, they might sound crazy to us today, but I'm sure probably some of the things we think they would think are crazy. And much of modern society today says that mathematical chance is the source of creation. Maybe a lot of people are saying there's maybe an intelligent design behind it, but it's surely an unknowable kind of design. Now, the Bible is deliberately coming against those things and saying, no, the God of the Bible, he created the universe and he created it out of nothing. And he is knowable. The passage does want us to grasp that God created the world. I mean, this is simple reality in some ways with huge and profound implications. And when God created, from that moment, everything has changed forever. As we know, a creation, the world will go through a story of its own, but creation itself will never be undone. The universe, creation, will never cease to be. Now, in all of this, I'm not saying this is not history, but it's just that it's not right for us to get caught up in too many of the details. I think this is both history and also a poetic song that, as you read the rest of chapter one, it has rhythm and repetition. And again, I think it's in many ways simple enough for my two-year-old to understand and yet deeply profound. And as you read it through, there is this amazing structure through the chapter one of God forming the world and then filling the world. And the first 3 days of creation, he forms the world. He separates night and day and water and sky and land and vegetation. He's forming. And then in the following 3 days, he fills what he has formed. And he puts lights in heaven. He puts fish and birds. He puts animals and humans into what he has formed. And day one corresponds to day four and two to five and three to six. And there's this beautiful symmetry where God has taken a dark, watery expanse of nothingness and turned it into a beautiful garden. And it says in the passage that the garden is pleasing, the trees in it that are pleasing to the eye and good for fruit. What an amazing concept that God would make things that are pleasing to the eye and good to eat. And he is clear, the Bible is clear, that creation is all good. Good in the way that, like, a melody is good, a piece of art is good, not like an Ofsted report or something. You know, it's good, not quite outstanding, it's just, yeah, it's good. No, it is good. And this is before humans. Goodness and beauty in creation, sunsets, waves crashing against the rocks, whatever it might be, the stars in the sky, this beauty has been evident since the beginning. And I think we all accept this now, that there is a beauty in this creation. The earth is itself good in some way and should be appreciated. And not just so that human life can be sustainable, but because it deserves it in and of itself. There's something beautiful about creation. We need to look after the planet. We are increasingly understanding that. And I think it's fair to say that we think this way. We care about the environment because of the influence of Genesis. Because we live in a post-Christian society. Not all worldviews think this way. That is certainly fair to say. And now some make too much and say creation is as good as God itself. No, but this is clear. Creation is good, but not God. And in fact, even the concept of goodness is evident from the beginning. Again, no one today really denies the existence of goodness, that some things we can say that is good and kind of pure and right, and therefore some things we can say that is not good. But where did that come from? The concept of goodness. Now, outside of accepting that there's a creator who defines what is good from the beginning, it's quite difficult to explain why we largely now mostly agree to a greater extent what is good and what is not. God created the world. That is the origin story of the universe. How exactly is not the focus of Genesis 1, but God did it. And all of it was good. And then the pinnacle, the climax, is when God creates humanity. The origin story of humanity. I read Genesis 1 from verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image." Again, the Trinity hinted at, "in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God, I'll carry on at 28 as well, actually. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." I don't know if you know what this is. If you can see that clearly enough, that if you are part of YA, you may know, because I may have done this with you before. What is the point of that? Now, you might know, you might not. No one is thinking, no, it hasn't got a point. That has no point, because it is clear that something, someone has designed this thing and made it. Now, if it is for separating the egg yolk from the white. You put the yolk in the, you know, as you can probably figure out. And we look at that, the reason I say that is because if something exists with no creator, it has no purpose. It is an accident. But if anything is created, then it is designed and created with purpose, with meaning. You have purpose and meaning because God designed and created you. Now, that's true for all of creation. All of creation has a purpose, but it is particularly true for humans who are set apart as special within God's creation. The rest of creation is good. In verse 31, after the humans are made, God saw all that he'd made and said, "It was very good." Now, if there's no creator, then humans are just part of the mess, right? It's we have no special value. And some thinkers like Peter Singer just admit that. Yeah, that's the case. There's no way we can say humans have special value. But Genesis says that humans are the pinnacle of creation. And uniquely, it says that God has made humanity in his image and in his likeness. So you have purpose and you also have deep intrinsic value as one who bears the image of God and reflects God. That is not tied to your output to your productivity in society or anywhere else. It is intrinsic to who you are. So that means those in the prime of life who are contributing loads to society, they have intrinsic value, but not because of what they're doing. The elderly lady who needs 24/7 care also has intrinsic value. The newborn baby that generally we all accept has value, does have intrinsic value, just as the unborn baby has intrinsic value. Whether it's got disabilities, whether it's got Down syndrome or other disabilities or not, there is intrinsic value, not just because of its future potential and input into society. No, intrinsic. All body types, all colours, all abilities have sacred value because God says so. However happy you are, however sad you are, however whole you feel, or however incomplete, however able or not able you are or feel, God says that you reflect His image, like cat's eyes reflect headlights from a car. The purpose as well is stated that we are to be like God. We humans are created to rule, to subdue, and to fill the earth. Now, not suppressing others, but serving others and ruling over the land. Like God, we are to be gardeners and cultivators. Interestingly, surveys, things done in the first lockdown, the number one hobby that was taken up in the UK was gardening. There's something in us that calls us to do it and to enjoy gardening and cultivating the land. And incidentally as well, you won't get sanctity of life or human rights without this theology, Christian or not. We think this way because of the Genesis origin story of humanity. The American Declaration of Independence was wrong to say that these things are self-evident. And there's a non-Christian historian, Tom Holland, says that all men have been created equal and endowed with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were not remotely self-evident truths. That most Americans believe they were owed less to philosophy than to the Bible. That every human being was created in God's image. The truest and ultimate seedbed of the American Republic, no matter what some of those who had composed its founding documents might have cared to think, was the book of Genesis. And the Bible is also clear, male and female, He created them. Two types of human that are totally equal and valuable. And much of creation is made of complementary pairs. The Bible paints a picture of union from those pairs, with earth and sky and heaven and earth and land and sea and man and woman. There's not sameness where we're identical. There's not otherness where we're kind of ulterior, but there is union. And the distinctions are not kind of exaggerated, but they're not eradicated, they're enjoyed. And it's not just better with men and women. Man needs woman. Woman needs man. If nothing else, biology shows this. You cannot fulfill our purpose to fill the earth without it. But it goes way beyond that as well. So far, so very good in creation. Then humanity starts making a mess and we get the origin story of sin. And I'll read from chapter 3, verse 4, where the serpent is speaking to Eve. He says, "You will not certainly die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were opened and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. God had forbidden this fruit and they ate it. Who knows how long this took to happen? Maybe it was the afternoon of the creation, maybe weeks or months later. The origin story of the serpent, of The devil is here as well. He's the father of lies. He's been accusing since the beginning. He's been exaggerating. He's trying to recruit to his rebellion. And it's been a classic narrative up to this point. Creation's been good and good, and you kind of know in these stories something's about to go wrong. And the serpent comes and twists God's words. Starts to saying, did God really say? Is that what God said? Kind of just asking, and then moves to being explicit. God was lying to you. That wasn't true. That's not true. And the serpent speaking to Eve, and Adam and Eve have a choice. There's these two particular trees in the garden. There's the tree of life, and there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that God has forbidden them to eat from. It's not a magic tree, but God is just exercising his divine right to say, don't eat that because I say so. Freedom is yours to do what you want with it. I'm telling you not to do it. And will they use their freedom of choice to trust God's definition of good and evil, or will they try and reach out and seize the opportunity to define good and evil for themselves? And there's a tragic irony that what they tried to gain was in what they tried to gain and against what they ended up losing. They wanted to be like God, what the serpent said. They already were. In trying to take God's place as the definer of good and evil, they became less like God, not more. They've taken the rule and authority that God gave them and started using it for themselves and not others. They're still image bearers of God, but now they're slaves to sin. Now they'll die. We as humans are bad at defining good and evil without God. And that's why from here on out, Genesis 1 to 11 particularly, things just go really bad. The great casualty in this passage is intimacy. Adam and Eve lose intimacy with God, and they lose it with one another. They're not just breaking rules by doing that, not just walking on the grass. This is a rebellion against God and a rejection of him and the relationship that he offers. When God asks questions, he's asking, not because he doesn't know the answer, but he's asking like a lover who finds their spouse having an affair. What have you done? It's important we realize that we would all have done the same thing here. The simple choice was to not eat. You either don't eat this fruit and therefore obey and trust God, or you eat and you disobey and you decide you think you know better. This is a great picture of what sin looks like for us. There's a temptation. We think, I know God has said not to do this, but I think if I do it, I think I'll be more free. I think I'll be happier. I think I'll know more liberty if I do this, and I'll enjoy it. And I reckon that this fruit that they ate, I think probably it was sweet, like a nectarine or something. Probably it was delicious for a bit. It wasn't the magic fruit. But then they realize that they have lost so much more than they've gained. That is sin for us. Sooner or later, we lose more than we gain. Whether that's a huge thing, like, you know, moving in with a partner, even though we say God wouldn't approve, we think, well, I just think this is what I need to do anyway. Or things like sharing a bit of gossip that we've got, and maybe taking an inappropriate second look at something we shouldn't be, opening an app on our phone we know is doing us no good, whatever it is. And we also often end up making a futile attempt to cover our shame. Like they made a futile attempt. They got fig leaves to try and cover their nakedness, which they're not that big. It wouldn't have worked. Sin now exists in the world. What was very good is now tainted. Still beautiful, but the world is fallen and it's broken and it's messy. But the story doesn't end there. We get the origin story of hope. The origin of sin has consequences, but God has a promise to make which points to a hope. In verse 14 and 15 of chapter 3, the Lord God said to the serpent, Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and all wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel." The promise is made of all people. First promise of the Bible to the serpent. And it's a mysterious promise that from the seed offspring of Eve will come a wounded victor of some sort. The consequences of rebellion are not undone here, but a promise is made. The serpent will come and strike the heel of this promised rescuer, and the serpent will think that he is victorious, but actually the rescuer will have allowed this strike on his heel, and in so doing he will crush the head of the enemy and take total victory. We see here that it's not just the universe that began with God, but hope and salvation and rescue begin with him too. And we go from here to searching for this promised seed, this offspring, through the book of Genesis, the rest of the Bible. Who is it? Where will this rescue come from? And we will see, as we go through Genesis, God making promise after promise. And we'll get glimpses and hints of the promise being fulfilled and moments of grace. There's one in verse 21 of chapter 3. Adam and Eve tried to cover their own shame with fig leaves. It was no good. And then in verse 21, it says, "The Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them." Probably blood spilled to do this. And vitally, God clothed them. God covered their shame. This is much more effective than their futile attempt to do so. And a hint at God's grace and rescue. And we'll follow through looking for the heirs of this promise. Where does the line go? The descendants go. But the rescuer doesn't come and doesn't crush the head of the enemy in the book of Genesis. We need to jump forward from Eden to another garden. And that's where we see how humans were always meant to rule as God had originally intended. In the Garden of Gethsemane, we see one who doesn't reach out to seize control or extra freedom, an attempt to define good and evil for themselves, or try and seize an opportunity to be like God for their own sake. But we see one who gave up equality with God, and the Son of God himself made himself nothing for the sake of others. And in that garden, the reversal occurs. And Jesus Christ didn't say to God the Father, "Not your will, but mine," like Adam and Eve. He didn't say, I know better. He said to God the Father, "Not my will, but yours." He was perfectly obedient to the Father on behalf of and for the sake of those who had rejected him. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. This is the great reversal and the beauty of the hope that is now both a future promise, which is all it was then, and now it is that still, and it's also a present reality for those who are in Christ Jesus. Those who are heirs according to the promise, who are in Christ, let's give ourselves to worshipping God, who is our creator and our purpose giver, the one whose image we reflect, and who is also our hope and our rescue and our salvation.